Welcome to Dialogue on WUOT. I'm Claire Heddles. Today's episode, what's next for post-election Tennessee? Polls are closed, and as the country awaits the results from the presidential election, we'll spend this hour discussing what to expect from the new Tennessee legislature, the battle surrounding voting rights, and Tennessee's newest laws, and the future of immigration policy in the state. I have some amazing experts and advocates on the show to help me unpack the election results. And due to social distancing guidelines, all of our guests are dialed in remotely. First, we have Carla McAnders, an attorney, professor of refugee and immigration law, and director of the Immigration Practice Clinic at Vanderbilt University. Previously, she was a tenured law professor at the University of Tennessee here in Knoxville. She serves on the American Bar Association's Commission on Immigration Advisory Committee and is a widely cited expert on immigration and refugee law. Carla, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Holly McCall, the editor-in-chief of Tennessee Lookout, a nonprofit news outlet covering Tennessee government and politics. Holly is both a longtime reporter and political strategist who extensively covered the path to Tuesday's election and has overseen Tennessee Lookout's COVID reporting. The watchdog digital news organization launched this spring and broke the story that Governor Bill Lee was giving names and addresses of COVID patients to law enforcement. So Holly, welcome to Dialogue.
Hey Claire, it's great to be here today.
And we have Tom Castelli, the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Tennessee. In recent months, the ACLU has brought multiple lawsuits against the state of Tennessee regarding voting rights during the COVID pandemic. Rulings in a case brought by ACLU expanded absentee voting to all voters with underlying health conditions in the August primary. So Tom, thank you for joining us today as well.
Thanks for having me.
And information about our panel and links to their work is at WUOT.org. And if you're listening in and would like to be a part of the discussion, email us your questions at WUOTnews@utk.edu or send them on Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM. And on that note, let's kick off the show. So Carla, I want to turn to you first to step a couple days back to lay the foundation for Election Day. So the day before the election, a U.S. judge blocked President Trump's public charge rule. And for those that missed the story in the election flurry, I wonder if you can explain a little bit the notion of public charges and the significance of Monday's ruling.
So, and first of all, in immigration law, there are provisions that exclude non-citizens from immigrating, coming to the United States on a more permanent basis, and receiving a green card or lawful permanent resident status. And one of those provisions is the public charge provision. And it gives the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of State, the discretion to exclude individuals who are likely to become dependent on government benefits in the future. And so that is in the text of the immigration law. And so what the Trump administration did is they significantly modified and altered the criteria under which a person would be deemed a public charge. And this, you know, expansion now includes if a person uses health benefits, housing benefits, nutrition programs, Medicaid, SNAP benefits, which were formerly food stamp benefits, then they could be deemed a public charge and ineligible to become a lawful permanent resident. And what, you know, the Trump administration has been doing is they will propose a regulation. And when you propose a new regulation, you have to comply with what's called the Administrative Procedures Act. You can't, you know, there are certain laws that say you have to follow certain procedures so that the public is informed about the changes that you're making. And so here, the judge halted the implementation of the public charge rule because he said, hey, Trump administration, you didn't follow certain steps in the law to change the criteria for who is deemed a public charge or likely to be take advantage or become dependent on public benefits. And so, you know, once again, we're seeing that the Trump administration is being halted in its implementation. It is a nationwide injunction, which means that, you know, the Department of State and, you know, viewing applications for immigrants coming here and the Department of Homeland Security and processing immigrant benefits are not going to be using those new rules that the Trump administration put into place.
And another significant factor leading up to this moment, yesterday's election, is Tennessee set a new record for COVID hospitalizations on Election Day with more than 1,400 patients. So, Holly, you've been overseeing Tennessee Lookout's reporting on COVID. What do you see as the interconnections between Election Day and COVID, and how might that have impacted what happened yesterday?
You know, I'm not sure that COVID had a huge impact on the election yesterday regarding voter turnout. You know, we had huge voter turnout. I would say, though, it has unfortunately become very partisan in the way the coronavirus and the treatment of it is handled. And certainly on a national level, the amount of support that turned out for President Donald Trump clearly seems to reflect the support for all of his policies. He's been, I'm not even sure I can find the right word for how he's handled COVID. It's been very wishy-washy. He's never really supported wearing masks. And there are clearly plenty of people who think that that is a fine policy. You know, and then I'm sure we'll get more into the state elections later. But again, you see the same thing at a state level. Governor Bill Lee has refused to order a mask mandate. He has said that county mayors should consider. And I honestly can't imagine a much more lukewarm statement than to say that someone should consider a mask mandate. But nonetheless, Republicans still hold a supermajority in the state house, and the percentages of partisan turnout was just about the same as it was in 2016.
And Tennessee is one of just five states that didn't expand absentee voting to all voters for the presidential election. But as Holly was saying, we saw increased voter turnout. So, Tom, can you talk a little bit about how different voter access was to the polls this election compared to 2016?
Sure. I think, well, one is because of the ruling by the Tennessee Supreme Court, absentee voting, which in Tennessee is an excuse only. So you have to fit into one of the several criteria, was expanded to include people that had a high risk of COVID complications or that were caretakers of those people. So that was a large shift in people who could, at least during a pandemic, vote absentee with a valid excuse. So I think that was one way, and I think that showed, and we saw a lot of absentee ballots being cast in Tennessee more than in both the August and the November election, more than we've ever had before. And I think that was in part because of this expansion, and in part because people who were already eligible, those that may have had other medical conditions or people over 60, which is a large block of people that are always been eligible to vote absentee, chose to use the mail ballot because of the pandemic. So I think that in that way, we saw kind of an expansion, so to speak, in the way people could vote. And then obviously the pandemic just affected how people voted. I think we saw a huge amount of early votes because people wanted to go ahead and get their vote cast and you know, didn't want to wait till Election Day and risk there being crowded lines like there may have been in years past. And so we saw, I think, a lot of people choosing to use the early vote option that's always been available in Tennessee.
And one of Trump's primary talking points in 2016 that continued to impact this election was immigration. And Carla, I wonder if you can talk about some of the difference between the formal federal Trump immigration policies that we've seen over the past 4 years and the implementation of those on the local level here in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the main things that we've seen in terms of increased immigration enforcement, each immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, has a local office that is in the state of Tennessee, throughout the state of Tennessee. And one thing that we saw the Trump administration do was increase the interior enforcement of immigration laws. And so one workplace raid, a larger workplace raid took place in Morristown, Tennessee. And, you know, when you have a workplace raid, it results in the separation of, you know, family members. You have mixed status families where you might have one parent who is undocumented and, you know, children who are U.S. citizens. And so in that raid, there were a lot of people were placed into removal proceedings. And secondly, the challenging of the conditions under which individuals were hired during that raid and what the employer did in terms of, you know, hiring undocumented immigrants and the conditions under which they were working. And so what we have seen in Tennessee directly is an increase in, workplace, worksite enforcement. The other side is just the travel ban had a significant impact on the refugee communities in the state of Tennessee. In our state, we have a significant population of Somali nationals. And when the travel ban went into place, there was a targeted removal of individuals, Somali nationals, and also Iraqi nationals. We have the highest Kurdish population outside of the Middle East in Nashville. And so those individuals, by the travel ban, if they had a prior removal order that was halted because it might be dangerous for them to return back to the country of origin, the Trump administration, detained a lot of individuals and attempted to remove them from the United States.
And you're listening to Dialogue, What's Next for a Post-Election Tennessee. If you have questions for our panelists, please email them to wuotnews@utk.edu or send them to us on Facebook and Twitter at WUOTFM. We'll get into election results and what they mean for Tennessee's legislature after the break.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the Next On Point, the day after Election Day, we'll have the latest from across the country on results on the race for the White House and the Senate, what tallies are known, what votes are still being counted, and what's next in this historic moment for the United States. That's on the Next On Point from NPR.
Tune in for On Point this afternoon beginning at 2 on WUOT2. Listen on an HD radio or in the WUOT mobile app.
Support for WUOT comes from Foothills Physical Therapy Center, family-owned since 92, working to help people get back to doing the things they love without pain or difficulty. In South Knoxville, near downtown, more at foothillspt.us.
Support for WUOT comes from East Tennessee Foundation, celebrating a 35-year anniversary, pursuing their mission to make lives better and communities stronger through thoughtful giving. More at easttennesseefoundation.org.
It is 19 minutes after 12 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're glad to have you with us for Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT, your public radio station.
Listening to Dialogue, What's Next for Post-Election Tennessee. I'm Claire Heddles, and I'm joined virtually by Carla McAnder, an immigration attorney and professor at Vanderbilt Law School, Holly McCall, editor-in-chief of the digital news outlet Tennessee Lookout, and Tom Castelli, the legal director of the ACLU of Tennessee. More on our guests is at WUOT.org. And Holly, we saw the Democrats flip just one state Senate seat and no House seats yesterday in Tennessee. Do you see Democrats having any more political power in the upcoming legislative session than they did this past year?
No. In short, the Democrats still remain in a super minority. There was a good bit of thought going into this election, not just from Democrats, but also from Republican strategists, that Democrats had the opportunity to flip two Senate seats, Senate District 10 around Chattanooga, Todd Garden hiring Glenn Scruggs. That was turned out to be a very close race. The Democrats did not pick that up. They did only pick up Senate 20 in Nashville. Heidi Campbell beat Steve Dickerson. There was also a thought that the Democrats would pick up to six state House seats. Several of those were very close. In Memphis, I don't remember the House number, but Gabby Salinas, who almost beat Senator Brian Kelsey in 2018. Again, that was another very close race. Not sure if she's going to ask for a recount. But the bottom line is that predictions were off once again, locally in the state as well as nationally. There was another seat. A couple of Republican strategists had told me they had given up on the Republican incumbent in Smyrna, Mike Sparks, and he ended up defeating Brandon Thomas pretty handily by 7 or 8 percentage points. So you've really got to pick up seats to be more effective. And even with some strong caucus members for the Democrats, they're still in a large super minority, and that's not going to do anything to help them, you know, pass legislation this year.
And after Tuesday's election results, the General Assembly will have its two first openly LGBTQ representatives. I'm wondering, Tom, if you think this will impact legislation towards LGBTQ people coming out of the legislature. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit as well about the primary legal battles you're bracing for Tennessee in regards to LGBTQ rights.
Sure. I mean, I think it's great, and I think it'll certainly provide a voice on the state legislature that has not been there before, and hopefully that will influence our state legislature. You know, we have seen years in the past several legislative sessions where there's been a seems like an all-out attack on LGBTQ rights, and so you know, I'm hopeful that this may influence that. But as you know, as Holly just pointed out, I mean, the makeup hasn't really changed in the state legislature. So I, you know, from the numbers, I don't see that there being a big shift there. Looking forward, I mean, we have seen. Just in this past session, there were laws passed that affected or allowed foster agencies to discriminate against LGBTQ families in placements. I think that we're kind of prepared to continue to kind of fight against laws like that will continue to discriminate against or disadvantage those families in our state. In fact, there's a case being heard by the Supreme Court today about that very issue out of Pennsylvania. So depending on the outcome of that, we may see further attempts by the state legislature to eat away at some of the rights of the families that are, you know, same-sex couple families. So there's that. And then there's, I think perennially we've seen attacks on the rights of transgender people, and particularly around students who are transgender. And we will, you know, we expect to see that continued effort from our General Assembly to disadvantage trans people in Tennessee as well.
And nationally and in Tennessee this summer, we saw a lot of verbal commitments from public officials to take action towards racial justice. And Carla, you've written a lot about the intersection of the immigration system and other systems of oppression like racism and anti-Blackness. And as these newly elected and reelected officials have the opportunity to take action on the kinds of commitments we are hearing this summer, I'm wondering if you can unpack a little bit the ways white supremacy influences immigration policy and its administration in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely an intersection between racial justice issues and immigration issues. When we talk about how the federal and local intersect with immigration and laws, it's readily apparent in the intersection of immigration and criminal law. So criminal laws are most enforced at the state and local level. And in America right now, we're having conversations around policing and the impact of race on policing. And so individuals who are of African descent, Afro-Latinx immigrants, Afro-Caribbean immigrants, and immigrants who come from the continent of Africa experience the immigration system in particular ways. And for example, 76% of Black immigrants are deported on criminal grounds compared to 45% of all immigrants. And despite making up only 7.2% of the population of non-citizens in the U.S., more than 20% of people who are facing deportation on criminal grounds are Black. And that is a particularly a relevant issue in Tennessee, because again, I mentioned that, you know, Somalis make up a significant population of the immigrants residing in Tennessee. And since the Trump administration has been in power, its policies have disproportionately impacted Black immigrants. For example, after the travel ban, Somali nationals, the deportation rates increased by 200% and more than doubled. And so we're seeing that at the intersection of, you know, the policing of certain communities, the policing of Black immigrant communities, that individuals who come into the country are racialized Black at the border. And they, you know, just like African Americans, disproportionately are targeted or pipelined into the criminal justice system, which can result in deportation.
And looking at these summers' widespread protests against racism, Tennessee's legislature called a special session to pass the law that made it a felony to camp on state property. Tom, I'm wondering if you can speak a bit more about what you expect in the legal challenges when it comes to this law moving forward.
Yeah, I think to begin, I think it's important that, I mean, the camping part of that was just part of this law. It affected a lot of different criminal laws that have traditionally kind of been leveraged against protesters, like trespass or blocking a road or thoroughfare or disrupting a meeting, and raised the minimum sentences for some of these criminal laws. But the one that I think has got the most attention and the most egregious was moving camping on state property from a misdemeanor to a felony. So we're making people who spend the night or sleep in a sleeping bag on state property felons, which takes away, not only does it incarcerate them, but it takes away all their civil rights, their right to vote, their right to hold office, the right to serve on a jury, until it can be restored, which is exceedingly hard in the state of Tennessee to restore those rights. You know, as far as legal challenges, I think that, you know, what we're looking at, we've been analyzing these statutes along with a lot of partner groups on whether there are legal challenges. I think ultimately when you're dealing with criminal laws, I think as Carla said, you know, the states traditionally are the ones that administer criminal laws and decide what the punishments are. So I think this was one of those things that was passed kind of in the, you know, I think literally at midnight during a special session of the state legislature, and the legislature needs to fix this. But there may be some ways to go after how these laws are enforced when they are used against people who are out there exercising their First Amendment right to protest. If these laws are leveraged in such a way that they interfere with those First Amendment rights, and then they could be attacked in that way. And then generally, I think some of the laws, particularly around camping, it's a little unclear exactly what it means. What is you know, digging in the earth, I think, is mentioned in there, or laying bedding down as if to sleep, you know, storing food for future use. I mean, these things are somewhat vague and may be subject to attack if criminal charges are brought against people for camping, for doing those things.
And Holly, you've written about what you call a lack of human decency in Tennessee's legislature. I wonder if you can speak more about what you mean by this and whether you anticipate that changing post-election.
Well, I have a lot to say about that. There's certainly a lack of personal decency on the part of some individual legislators, notably former Speaker of the House, Glenn Cassata, who was reelected yesterday with 60% of the vote in his district. You know, he tapped into his fellow legislators' offices. He set up white noise machines so nobody could listen to what was going on with him. You know, a spate of emails and texts came out where he had staff members using racial epithets, talking about drug use. But beyond that, I think there is an institutional lack of decency over the last 5 to 10 years, and it seems to get worse by the year. You know, Thomas just mentioned this law that would felonize camping on state property. Let's be really clear, that's directed towards one group of people, and it was the Black Lives Matter protesters who were camping out to try to get an audience with Governor Bill Lee. That's it. They wanted to talk to him. And rather than talking to him, the legislature has passed a law that makes it illegal. Will I get arrested and be charged with a felony if I put a pack of peanut butter crackers under a blanket and sit on a legislative plaza? I seriously doubt it. But then you've also got issues like, I think the one that stands out most clearly to me is the failure to expand Medicaid in the state. This is billions and billions of dollars that are sitting in a fund. Tennessee taxpayers have paid into this. This is our money. And yet Tennessee legislators just don't want to accept funds because it was an Obama-era program. And the result of this is we've had, I think it's 13 rural hospitals now, 13 rural hospitals. So if you need to get to a hospital, if you have a heart attack, you might be going 45 minutes to an hour. It's fiscally wrong. It is spiteful. You've got laws that like felonize aspects of getting abortion. And they're not only inhumane and indecent, they're stupid. They are costing the state money in lawsuits. And, you know, Republicans will say, when you bring this up, Republican legislators will typically say, well, Democrats were corrupt, too, when they had a majority. And let me be clear, Democrats, when they had a majority for years from Reconstruction on, did a lot of stupid and corrupt things, too. But one of the first ethical lessons we all learn as children is two wrongs don't make a right. Decency should not be a partisan issue. And just because you have a supermajority should not entitle you to take retribution on your constituents.
And I want to stay back a little bit and take a look at how the outcome of the presidential election, an outcome we're all waiting for, will influence Tennesseans. So, Tom, if Biden wins, there'll be a slew of federal judge appointments. What impact do you think this would have on the work of the ACLU in Tennessee?
Well, I mean, I actually looked at it today, and right now, I think the only two open federal seats are in the Eastern District. So obviously that would be, you know, two new judges in the Eastern District, and it could affect that district. I think the other interesting thing would be, I mean, Tennessee is a growing state and long overdue to add federal judges. I think we added one seat in the Western District 4 years ago. There was talk of adding another seat in the Middle District, but I don't know that that's happened. Or it hasn't happened. I don't know what happened to those talks. But so, you know, in addition to these two open seats in the Eastern District of Tennessee, we could see some additional seats added in Tennessee. You know, when we're talking about appointing federal judges, also you can't ignore the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which has never been a what I think, you know, people would call a friendly court of appeals to a lot of civil rights issues. But it's never, you know, it's also been kind of friendly on certain aspects and not on others, you know, and if Biden were elected and appointed additional or filled some of the seats in the six, you know, that could change kind of the makeup of the Sixth Circuit. And of course, all of this is, you know, somewhat reading tea leaves, but also dependent upon the fact that we now have a 6-3 majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's going to filter down to whatever happens. You know, these courts of appeals judges and our district court judges, no matter who appointed them, are bound to follow the precedents of the U.S. Supreme Court. And so if we get negative rulings from this new court down the road, that's going to affect anything we do in the state of Tennessee and across the country.
And one of the interesting things about this presidential race is that we've kind of seen both candidates in a presidential administration. We saw Trump's administration and we saw Biden as a vice president. So I'm wondering, Carla, if you could talk a little bit about the most significant changes to immigration policy that have impacted Tennesseans over the past 4 years and the 8 years prior that Biden was in the Obama administration.
I think the most significant change that we've seen with the Trump administration is with immigration policy, there are many, but significantly altering the way in which the immigration courts function, and in terms of allowing a immigration judge to have discretion over their docket, you know, case completion rates. And in the state of Tennessee, the immigration court is located in Memphis. And so when we talk about the, you know, federal policies becoming local, whenever the Trump administration makes a change that's, you know, directly implemented within that court and has an impact on individuals who are in removal proceedings, deportation proceedings across the state of Tennessee. Over the last two decades, the state of Tennessee has seen a demographic change, not just Tennessee, but in the South, of immigrant communities. And Tennessee has, over the past decade, had the fastest growing immigrant population in the country. And so, you know, those policies that we see are the changes that the administration makes in immigration has a direct impact on the immigrant communities here in the state of Tennessee. One thing in 2014 under the Obama administration, we saw a surge of unaccompanied minors coming into the United States. A lot of those unaccompanied minors, if they had a friend, family member, not a family member, or a parent residing in Tennessee, would be placed with a parent pending their removal proceedings. And so, you know, from like 2014 to the present, you still have unaccompanied minors who are in removal proceedings and, you know, challenging their removal and applying for immigration release. And I think under any administration, the court system is backlogged, the processing of immigration claims is backlogged. And so whatever administration is next is going to have to address the significant backlogs and the ways in which the current administration has altered the processing of immigration cases through immigration court.
And you're listening to Dialogue, What's Next for a Post-Election Tennessee. If you have questions for our panelists, please email them to wuotnews@utk.edu or send them to us on Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM.
Foreign powers that want to meddle with the election are...
Reporters for the World look beyond our borders.
I've been speaking with a few people inside Iran about
how... Presidents of Guatemala, Honduras, Bolivia...
Next time on The World, global reaction to the U.S. election.
Actually, here in the U.K., in our last general election...
All eyes on the U.S., on The World.
Tune in for The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock on WUOT 2. Support for WUOT comes from Aptus Design Works, providing local companies access to a team of mechanical, electrical, and industrial engineers and designers to help create new products and processes. Details at aptusdesign.com. The time is 12:38 on a Wednesday afternoon, November 4th. You're listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT, your public radio station, online at wuot.org. Thank you for tuning in. We'll get you back to Dialogue in just a moment. Coming up at 1 o'clock, news headlines from NPR News, the latest on the election 2020 results. Also on the way at 1 o'clock, the Wednesday edition of our afternoon concert program. Again, Dialogue continues in a moment on WUOT.
Dialogue, What's Next for a Post-Election Tennessee. I'm Claire Heddles, and I'm joined virtually by Carla McAnder, an immigration attorney and professor at Vanderbilt Law School, Holly McCall, editor-in-chief of the digital news outlet Tennessee Lookout, and Tom Castelli, the legal director of the ACLU of Tennessee. More on our guests is at WUOT.org, and if you'd like to send them a question, you can send it to WUOTnews@utk.edu or on Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM. And I want to turn to COVID for just a minute. Holly, when it comes to COVID under the Trump administration, Governor Lee has flouted some of the White House recommendations, as you mentioned earlier, like issuing a statewide mask mandate and closing bars. So how much will the outcome of the presidential race, the outcome we're waiting for, influence Tennessee's COVID response? And to what extent is Governor Lee kind of doing his own thing?
You know, I think it's pretty clear at this point that Governor Lee is doing his own thing. You've had several White House officials. Dr. Deborah Birx came to Tennessee in, time runs together this year. It was July or August, and stood with Governor Lee and said, you know, it is time for a mask mandate. And a reporter said to him, well, are you going to do what she said? And he basically said, no. I mean, he literally said, no, we're not going to do that. You know, very calm. This is not the plan. And then even more recently, there were some documents that actually was it you guys who got the documents from the White House?
It was actually.
Yeah, you guys obtained documents via public information, public request. I'm stuttering today since I was up late, but you guys got documents from the White House showing that Tennessee was in the red zone, and the White House itself was saying to Tennessee, y'all need to get your stuff in line and get a mask mandate, and still nothing. So I just don't see why we should expect anything to change. You know, again, Republicans kept their supermajority in the Tennessee legislature. There's going to be no pressure on Governor Lee to do anything differently. Certainly if Donald Trump keeps the White House and we don't know what's going to happen there, there is absolutely no reason for him to change.
And I want to shift a little bit on the very local level here in Knox County, because Knox County is one of just two counties in the state that reports arrests to ICE, which has led to a lot of protests and legal battles over data on the ICE partnership. And so, Carla, I wonder if you could talk about how you've seen the prevalence of ICE raids or fear of ICE change under the Trump administration in Tennessee, and what changes you anticipate moving forward for counties like Knox County that have a partnership with ICE.
On a broad scale, this administration has expanded a program, or it's called expedited removal. And so pre-Trump administration, expedited removal meant that if Customs and Border Patrol officers came across anyone within a 100-mile radius of the border, that they could, and they didn't have proper documentation to be in the country, that they could be removed, summarily removed, and given a removal order with very restricted ability to appeal the Border Patrol officer's removal order. The Trump administration has attempted to expand expedited removal to not just that 100-mile radius, but anyone who has entered the United States without inspection within the last 2 years. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, the interior enforcement of immigration laws, can enter expedited removal orders. And so what this means is, for example, if we had individuals who were apprehended in the Morristown raid and they were placed into removal proceedings and they entered within 2 years, this would give ICE the ability to enter a removal order and have someone summarily removed from the United States without access to a hearing, without access to due process rights, or in very limited means to challenge that removal order. And so I see the expansion. Of course, this is being litigated right now. And you know, we'll see whether this new rule will go into effect. But that expansion of expedited removal is going to alter the ways in which interior enforcement of immigration laws happen and significantly expand the individuals who can be removed without access to due process rights.
And we've seen a lot of attention, and journalists like myself have spent a lot of time on voting rights cases and COVID in recent months. But as you're talking about some of these legal battles when it comes to immigration, I'm wondering if, Tom, you could also speak about what kinds of non-voting rights cases you think are going to be the most influential in the coming months?
With regard to Tennessee, I mean, I think right now, I mean, what we've seen from the state is an all-out attack on reproductive freedom. We filed, I think, in the last 12 months, I think I've filed 5 different lawsuits revolving around the right to obtain an abortion. And in that same legislative session that we talked about earlier, the midnight session where we made camping a felony, they also passed a heartbeat ban on abortion, as well as some other problematic restrictions. So we're in the courts now on all of those. Those are going to play out over the course of probably the next several years. Like I said before, the Supreme Court's going to be integral. These bans are not uncommon across the country. But I think that is a big battleground right now, is what happens to reproductive freedom in Tennessee and in the country. And that's not just about abortion access. I mean, it can be about access to contraceptives and just general privacy rights. So a lot is on the line there. And I think that's one area really to watch moving forward. The other thing I think is, you know, we don't have any active lawsuits, but we mentioned it earlier about the right to freedom of speech or the right to protest. And we've seen crackdowns in Tennessee with this legislation but also across the country with the Trump administration, you know, having a overwhelming kind of antagonism to the right to freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. So I think that's another area that kind of coming out of COVID, and hopefully one day we'll be out of COVID, but that won't go away, is this kind of, you know, where is free speech? Where are freedom of speech rights, the rights to assemble? Where are they going in the future?
And Holly, from an editorial perspective, I'd like to hear more about what your coverage plans are and what you think our listeners should be dialed into as key issues in the coming months and as the new General Assembly starts early next year.
You know, we launched in the middle of a pandemic, and between COVID and an election year, there's never a shortage of issues to cover. I feel really strongly about people paying attention to state and local issues. You know, presidential issues that's a big ticket and it's glamorous and we all get interested in that. But what affects the four of us here and our listeners are these elections on a more granular level. What happens in the state legislature? What happens at your local city council? You know, and the governor will announce his legislative agenda right after Christmas, typically. I think some of the things we could look at this year is, you know, there was a special set, not a special session, but there were some committee meetings back in the summer talking about limiting the governor's scope of power. Governor Lee has issued, I think, 51 executive orders since March. Most of them are COVID related, but there is a group of legislators who want to limit the governor's scope of power. That's going to continue to unroll in the next legislative session. I'm looking at some notes that I made to myself here, so that's why I'm looking away from the screen. But there's also, there's word that Governor Lee has a piece of legislation that's going to be coming up. It's called balanced billing, and it's about the scope of practice by nurses. So you're going to have big insurance companies duking it out with hospitals versus nurses and doctors. And then the other thing that's going to come back up that was one of the hot issues last year is, I think the school vouchers issue is going to come back up. And this was the bill that was ruled unconstitutional, in which parents could get a chunk of money to send their kids to the school of their choice rather than to a public school. There was a lot of debate about it. You know, votes were flipped. That actually passed in the 2019 session. You know, it only affected a couple of school districts in the state. And, you know, again, it's been declared unconstitutional by Chancellor Ann Martin in Nashville. But that is clearly something that is close to the governor's heart, and that's going to come back up.
Mm-hmm. Just real quick, that was also affirmed by the Court of Appeals, Judge Martin's ruling pretty recently. So expect to see the voucher issue go up to the Tennessee Supreme Court.
I'm just going to add one more thing. You know, once again, like Thomas has referred to the balance on the Supreme Court. When you've got a conservative Supreme Court, again, particularly if Donald Trump remains the president, and then you've still got a conservative supermajority, I think we can expect to see these bills that infringe on people's personal rights, which I find just so bizarre, especially when the Republican Party typically is the party of individual freedom.
And Carla, what are your biggest concerns when it comes to immigration policy or refugee policy in the coming months that you think listeners should know about?
I think as Tom and Holly have mentioned, that the makeup of the Supreme Court is significant. Over the last, you know, 5 years, we've seen a significant number of challenges to the Trump administration's policies that have gone up to the Supreme Court. And so whether or not, you know, the federal courts will be deferential to the executive branch's immigration policy, which, you know, baked in the structure of immigration laws is deference to executive and congressional actions. And so I think that, you know, the Supreme Court's, the makeup of it is, and depending on who, you know, is elected the next president, we could see more of these policies become more entrenched that I've discussed over the course of the last hour.
And Tom, I'm gonna ask you, a Democratic Senate candidate, Marquita Bradshaw, who didn't win, but she made it a mantra during her race that Tennessee is not a red state, it's a low turnout state. And so as we looked at the results from yesterday and as we await the national results, of course, there are a lot of Republicans in the state but Tennessee is a low turnout state. So I'm wondering, from your perspective at the ACLU, what are some of the primary legal structures that produce low turnout here?
Well, I think we make it exceedingly hard to vote in the state of Tennessee. One thing I hope to see is continued expansion of vote by mail. I think in both the August and November elections, the state handled the increased vote by mail turnout. I haven't heard of any problems with it. And it does expand access to the ballot box. I think another thing that we can look at is I think we had a huge surge in voter registration this year. And I'm not sure where, I think the last numbers I looked at, it looked like there was about 4.5 million people or close to that mark registered to vote, which is great because we were, lagging way behind the rest of the country and just people getting registered to vote. But, we can make it easier to register to vote. I mean, we have these kind of arbitrary 30-day, you have to register to vote 30 days before an election. An election year like this one, there were, three elections this year? So, there were these kind of constant, starts and stops. If you didn't get it in time, maybe you missed the primary, or the August primary. We've got technology now that we can figure this out. If we have the political and the capital will to figure this out, we can follow other states into same day voter registration. I mean, there were several states yesterday where you could show up at the polls and vote. You didn't have to jump through these hoops of registering online or by mail. And we also have, the voter ID laws is another problem. I mean, we saw it this year with Tennessee has a rule that if you've never voted in person, you can't vote by mail because you have to show up and show this voter ID. I think the judge invalidated that this year. And I don't think there've been, again, no problems with that. So I think taking a hard look at how we grant access to the ballot box for everybody might increase that voter participation. Now, whether that would turn the state any less red than the state was in this election or not, I have no idea. But it certainly is in keeping with what I think democracy is about, which is let people vote. Let everyone that wants to vote, vote. It's eligible.
And on top of just voting, Carla, you've written about the intersection of the immigration system and racism. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what kind of action you've seen on the ground to dismantle these interconnected systems, either from activists or from political officials.
Well, I think one thing that was interesting that came about a couple years ago in response to the pushback to sanctuary cities is a movement to create freedom cities. And what the freedom city movement was around the country was the collaboration between immigrant activists and racial justice advocates and realizing that the same systems that impact in incarceration rates of, African Americans also are impacting Black and Brown communities. And instead of, targeting, isolated policies, groups, grassroots organizations have come together in these freedom cities and, created ordinances that address, police targeting certain communities, that address the ways in which individuals, if they are arrested, if I'm a lawful permanent resident and I've been residing in the country for a long time, if I, commit a certain crime and I engage with the criminal justice system, even if I'm a lawful permanent resident, I can be deported and removed to my, country of origin. And so I think, engaging in, transformational solidarity where we realize, the ways in which incarceration operates and the way at the intersection that there are ways that we can work together instead of working in silos.
And we have about 5 minutes left. I think I want to open the floor and see if anyone has anything else they want to add for our listeners for our last 5 minutes as we think about the elections results we saw yesterday and the presidential results we're expecting later today or later this week. So maybe, Holly, I'll start with you. Do you have any final comments you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would just like to add on to what Thomas was saying a couple of minutes ago about expanding voter registration and voter access. This should not be something we've seen this another issue that's fallen out along partisan lines. And I would certainly hope that Republicans would be more open to expanding voter registration and access, because what the results showed yesterday is that even with mail-in voting and more people registered to vote, the state still broke for Republicans. So the old train of thought is that more voters helps Democrats. That clearly was not the case here.
And Tom, do you want to add any final thoughts?
Yeah, just to kind of add to that and what I was saying earlier, I think another area where we are prohibiting a whole lot of people from voting is in our former felon population, and felony disenfranchisement in Tennessee is some of the most restrictive in the country. We make it very hard to get your rights back. We tie it to the ability to pay legal financial obligations like court costs. Some people will never get the right to vote back because they just owe too much money. And tying your right to vote to your wealth just seems very anti-democratic and anti-American to me. I think we can work on that, and we can make sure that people that may have in their past been convicted of a felony can still participate in the democracy and vote. And I think that's something really important to look at. And that, you know, that potentially would affect, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of Tennesseans who have been disenfranchised over the years.
And Carla, I'll give you the last word if you have anything else you want to add before we wrap up this episode of Dialogue.
Yes, I would just like to echo that voting is important. Immigration is controlled by our political branches. The Congress makes a uniform rule of naturalization, and the executive branch enforces. And so the power of voting and changing the ways in which the immigration system functions is, you know, contingent upon access and rights to vote.
Well, thank you all so much for joining me. That was Carla McAnder, an immigration attorney and professor at Vanderbilt Law School, Pauli McCall, editor-in-chief of the digital news outlet Tennessee Lookout, and Tom Castelli, the legal director of the ACLU of Tennessee. And you've been listening to Dialogue, What a Post-Election Tennessee Might Look Like. I'm your host, Claire Heddles, and I also want to extend a thank you to Greg Hill and Brandon Hollingsworth for their help in producing this show. Thank you to our panelists for sharing your insight with us, and to our listeners for tuning in. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News on 91.9 FM. This is your NPR news station.